So with that, I'm going to bring on one of the first guests, who is Vijay Brashad, who's a professor, organizer, speaker, analyst. Vijay, you on the phone?
Yes, thanks a lot, Eric.
Sure, I'm very happy to have you. One of the things that we were trying to figure out is that we really want to front-load the conversation about Iraq, the present situation in Iraq, and the present situation in the Indian subcontinent with the Pakistani and Indian conflict. But Tammy had actually, you know, emphasized that if you could, in 5 minutes, give us this very brief discussion, which would only be a coming attraction for your talk this Thursday night, about what about the chickens coming home to roost? You know, I mean, when Bob Wing and Max Elbaum said, don't use that expression after September 11th, I disagreed with that because I thought it wasn't so much just that the chickens were coming to home to roost in the broad conceptual sense that the United States had inflicted so much suffering on the Third World that finally someone from the Third World attacked the United States back, which would be valid enough. But rather, it was more specific than that, that these were actually U.S.-made and hatched chickens.
Correct.
So in that context, why don't you tell us a little bit about your analysis of the direct relationship between the U.S. role in the Middle East and what happened on September 11th?
See, the thing is that the way people now in the United States and the other advanced industrial countries see places like West Asia, North Africa, the Middle East, or South Asia is as places tormented by religion and therefore with religious fanaticism. And so they understand the attack on the United States as somehow, you know, this fanaticism bubbling over and irrationally coming and hitting the United States. That's a very unfortunate understanding, and it's a very dangerous myth to perpetuate. What it forgets is that these regions of the world at one time, and to some extent still, were rich with left, progressive, communist organizing. They had a rich opposition to imperialism, and in some ways these were the forefronts against imperialism. And what occurs from the 1950s to the 1980s is something very significant, and this is what it is. For the United States, the growth of the left in Arabia, in Iraq, in Sudan, in Indonesia, India, you name it, the growth of the left was seen as the main enemy. And the moment the United States, as state policy, decided that the left had to be crushed at all costs, the United States made alliances with the most despicable characters, despite the fact that the U.S. government knew fully well that these people hated the United States as well. Case in point, best example, two of them, one from Afghanistan. The American major ally in Afghanistan was a man named Gulbuddin Hikmatyar. Hikmatyar is interesting because his party was not only opposed to the Soviet Union, but more opposed to the United States and the values of the Enlightenment. They saw Christianity, the Enlightenment, and the United States as their principal enemy, but they understood they could take advantage of the U.S. to hit the Soviets hard. And they were major beneficiaries. In fact, most surface-to-air missiles provided by the United States went to Hikmatyar's group, which they then turned, interestingly, on the United States and still today. So that's one case in point. Knowing full well, William Casey, the head of the CIA, when he met Hikmatyar, wrote quite transparently that this guy is trouble, but he is our trouble. And they went with him, Afghanistan. In Afghanistan as well, the United States allied with another man, this man more as a financier, even though he fashioned himself as a mujahideen or soldier of God, and his name we now know, of course, Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden was the second great ally in Afghanistan, but he is of Saudi extraction. In Saudi Arabia, from the 1960s, not the 1970s and 80s when the Afghan conflict was on, but in the 1960s, the United States had made a pact already with the devils of right-wing reaction, to crush the left in Saudi Arabia. You know, people, when I go and speak, you know, in the United States, people are shocked to hear that Saudi Arabia had Marxist political parties.
Hmm.
In fact, people don't even remember that until yesterday's history, that is recently, South Yemen was a Marxist republic. It was not a Gulf state ruled by a bunch of sheikhs. It was a Marxist republic. There were about 12 Marxist parties battling with each other in South Yemen. And South Yemen was Osama bin Laden's first point of stop after Saudi Arabia. He was sent by the royal family to foment trouble in South Yemen. That was before he goes to Afghanistan. In other words, people like bin Laden and Hikmat Yar became the allies of the United States, even though the U.S. government knew full well that neither of these men were in any way associated with the values of the Enlightenment, etc. But on the contrary, they had a deep antipathy to the United States and to also, of course, left politics. And so in that sense, to say chickens and coming home to roost is hardly controversial. Because after all, you can just go to the writings of Casey, William Casey, the head of the CIA. You don't even have to go to Chalmers, Johnson, or people like that after the fact. But during the time, Bill Casey writes in his own, you know, words that these guys are trouble, they are our trouble. So I would say that it should not be controversial to say that the chickens came home to roost, precisely because this was anticipated. This is not something after the fact that you and I will have to analyze or, you know, construct. They
right.
anticipated trouble from these people, and they got trouble. But meanwhile, they left behind an Afghanistan and an Iraq, which by the mid-80s no longer had the progressive political parties that they used to. I just want to say one thing, and I'll come back to you. And that one thing is this. Just consider this. In 1958, in Iraq, 500,000 Iraqis were members of the Iraqi Communist Party. 500,000 people in 1958. Iraq had the largest Communist Party in West Asia. The other country with a large Communist Party was Sudan. Sudan, outside South Africa, had the, because there the numbers are not well known, many people were underground by the 50s, but above ground party, Sudan had the largest Communist Party in Africa. Today, both Sudan and Iraq are in a difficult situation socially because the left is disorganized, the left is confused, and the left has been entirely overrun by these forces of reaction.
Well, I think this is very, very helpful. And for those of the people, again, we urge you to come to hear Vijay Prashad. And Thursday night, we're talking about his many titles, Associate Professor of International Studies at Trinity College. Thursday night, this Thursday night, September 1st, at Cadesan, 2845 West 7th, L.A., at the corner of Hoover. And you can call us today at 213-387-2800 to get more information about the event. People are standing by for your call. Next question, Vijay, is let's fast forward to the present. I'm having a heck of a time figuring out what's going on there, of course. I don't know why the New York Times isn't helping me that much, you know. But one of the things I find very interesting, from my own, I wouldn't say prejudices, but my own ignorance, is in the absence of a Communist Party, with the perception, of course, of the Saddam Hussein dictatorship, which was not an illusion, with the confusion in my own mind about what different forces existed in terms of Sunnis, in terms of the Kurds, the Ba'ath Party, and so forth, I am very confused about why the resistance is doing so well. I mean, they're always, according to Mr. Bush, they're just sort of a handful of left. First, they were a handful of leftover Saddam loyalists. They're terrorists. Now it's interesting, they've now used the word insurgent as a bad word. I mean, it used to be communist, socialist, terrorist, but now we have to kill the insurgents. But why is the resistance so strong? Why is the growing perception among establishment forces that the United States probably can't win there, and therefore the demand for immediate withdrawal is even growing to some Republican guy from Oklahoma? Who are these forces in Iraq that are continuing to lead this resistance?
Well, you know, the first thing I should say is that, you know, it's very hard to get information. So much of the information comes through all kinds of lenses. But let me just try to give you my sense. My sense is the following. First thing, just imagine if a occupying power comes into L.A., what would happen? What kind of forces would emerge to take guerrilla action against the occupying power? Who would be capable of doing it? We are a disorganized society largely, but there are some organized groups that might have access to weapons, etc. Then there would be others who would come and join them and such. So one has to first have a kind of theoretical understanding of how a resistance against occupation occurs. Iraq was a very organized society. It didn't suffer from our level of relative disorganization. It was a very organized society. There is an Iraqi Communist Party today. It is above ground. It had the first major rally after the Saddam regime fell, and they produced the first newspaper on the streets of Baghdad. They took the position that one cannot go into insurgency mode, but we have to build Iraqi civil society. Therefore, they joined the Coalition Provisional Authority, and now they believe in the constitutional process. So they exist. By the way, during the Saddam period, it was these activists who provided almost all the information for the human rights organizations in London that cataloged atrocities by the Saddam regime. So they were, you know, very organized through the Saddam period. But they are probably not in the insurgency, maybe some people, but not the bulk of them. It is probably true that there are a lot of Ba'ath Party people in the insurgency, in the resistance. There are probably a lot of Ba'ath Party people. But it's interesting. It puts the lie to the idea of any party as being entirely dominated by one man. It's an authoritarian ideology, Ba'ath. It's a kind of socialist fascism, for sure, produced in Syria by Michel Al-Faq in the 1940s. It's a very troublesome history. But nonetheless, the Ba'ath wasn't just Saddam Hussein. It had not collapsed to one man. It's a very organized force right through civil society. It's fundamentally likely that many Ba'ath Party local people are involved in the resistance. And it is also true that the best organized forces with guns that entered Iraq from Iran were the Iranian people who took exile in Iran, the Iraqis who fled after 1991, after they rose in southern Iraq, and when the United States failed to give them any air support because they were told, rise and we'll support you. When they were being crushed by Saddam in 1991-92, they fled to Iran. They were very organized, armed militias. They enter Iraq. Many of them continue with the gun. So there are a number of different social forces that are battling U.S. occupation. It's not clear that we can identify which are the main ones. Another thing comes to the surface is that these forces are not functioning without cross-class support. Patrick French, who went and stayed with the insurgency for almost 1 year, wrote a series of pieces. He's a Canadian journalist. He published a piece in Harper's last year, but then he's written different places in Canada. He's produced an interesting analysis from Fallujah, where he was based, where he shows that merchants, other small merchants, small business people, small capital, etc., had begun to fund the resistance because they were frustrated by the suffocation of the U.S. occupation. In other words, the U.S. occupation was giving boondoggles to contractors, many of them from the Gulf states, not from Iraq, and much of the business and profit was going anyway to U.S. corporations. So small capital and merchants within Iraq feeling suffocated, Patrick French reports, were beginning to support the resistance. This is an interesting development. In other words, we have some cross-class support. It's not just, the rising of small Ba'ath officials, etc. It's not just those who were, you know, from the state, but also people who are small merchants and others. So this is an interesting development. But like you, there is no information here. Very few journalists go and talk to the resistance. I read the press from, around the world. You know, I subscribe to magazines from overseas. Some of them are informative, but many of them really have a mystified understanding. They don't go and find out the details of the resistance.
Okay, Vijay, that's good. And let me, hold on, excuse me. I'm going to move you very quickly now to the Indian subcontinent. And this is the kind of conversation, again, we're going to be having this Thursday night, September 1st. I'm with Vijay Prashad, who's an associate professor of international studies at Trinity College. This is Eric Ban with Tammy Bang Liu. One of the things I'm trying to understand is let's talk about India and Pakistan a little bit and what role they're playing in the kind of world balance of forces right now. We know somewhat that Pakistan is in a complicated situation because on one hand it's trying ostensibly to be an ally in the so-called war against terror. On the other hand, I believe it is a Muslim, predominantly Muslim country with tremendous support internally for Al-Qaeda or other insurgents against the United States. And secondly, not clear it has the will or the capacity to suppress, wasn't Saddam, Osama bin Laden at one time in Pakistan. And then in terms of India, the growing, amazing capitalist success at the top layer of India that's going down fairly deep into the society, but fairly deep by one, as I was saying, Samir Amin's assessment, going down 200 million people deep, meaning that some people are actually benefiting with, you know, small jobs and some people are making a lot of money, leaving 800 million people out of a billion totally frozen out. So, and then there's the rise of Hindu conservatism. So again, in these very early roadmaps, I mean, folks will have to come Thursday night to hear much more deeply. Just give us a little sense of some of what we would call the map out a little bit some of the contending forces. Oh yes. And one last good thing, which is I know that you are very friendly with a lot of the communist forces in India and that there actually are very vital, socialist and communist forces in India. Somehow weave that into the mix as well. And you have 5 minutes, brother.
5 minutes, okay.
Yes.
Well, let's take all three separately. First, before coming to all three, I should say that generally when people talk in the United States about India and Pakistan, they go straight to Kashmir. But I won't talk about Kashmir now. Kashmir is a different story. To some extent, Kashmir becomes the alibi for the elites of India and Pakistan not to deal with their internal problems. And the focus on Kashmir actually allows them to focus on their bordering state to give them some legitimacy. If you need to understand the logic of this, you can read that old renegade George Orwell's book, 1984. States keep fighting each other just to take the mind of the population off their own problems. Anyway, that said, Pakistan first. Pakistan, again, in the 1970s, faced a mass upheaval against, you know, the rule of the bourgeoisie, a very strong landlord industrial bloc that dominates Pakistan, high level of inequality. In the 70s, there were mass struggles, student struggles in Balochistan, a region today which is rife with right-wing reaction. Balochistan was the province of the Baloch Student Organization in the 1970s, a Marxist group whose leader was at that time in the 70s based in Afghanistan, which had a revolution, was a Marxist state. At any rate, in the 70s in Pakistan, there was a great deal of hope and anticipation. In the 1970s in Pakistan, a military coup transpires led by Ziaul Haq from the military, backed by the United States, when he was killed in a plane crash, in a plane explosion in 1989. On his plane was the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, Rafael, whose wife then became the head of South Asia for the State Department in the Clinton administration. Very close ties between Zia and the U.S. Government. And Zia moved to a policy of Islamization. And he understood that Islamization was the other pillar to the Afghan campaign, which was backed by the U.S. These things are all very much intertwined and interrelated. The thing I talked about earlier with Afghanistan, most of these people like Hekmatyar, etc., Bin Laden, they were based in Pakistan fighting the Afghan campaign. They were based in South Waziristan, where it is believed Bin Laden is currently located, in the province of South Waziristan in the northwest frontier. At any rate, the current leader of Pakistan, Parvez Musharraf, is also a military man. He conducted a coup in 1999, and he is between a rock and a hard place. In other words, the rock is that he has to maintain the power of this landlord industrial class. That is unshakable in Pakistan in alliance with the military. The hard place is that there is a growth from below where populist uprising has taken on an Islamist caste because there is no other ideology available to people. This is a combustible mix for Pakistan. That's Pakistan. In India, fortunately, last year there was a general election where the left won 61 seats in parliament, the communists won 61 seats, and the Congress won significantly to shut out the Hindu nationalists from a six-year reign of power, during which time they had made an alliance with Israel and hoped to become, with the United States, a triangle. Israel, India, USA, three democracies to take on Islam. That was the Hindu nationalists' position. During their six-year rule, they had tried to cement that alliance. When the Congress won a substantial number of seats in the last election, they joined with the communist forces and formed a government. The communists played an interesting role. Communists said, we will not join the government, we'll support you from outside. And we'll talk about this further on Thursday, but what was interesting was they created a new strategy. This is not a popular front or united front strategy because they said, listen, friends, you're on your own in government because we know we don't agree with you on most things. We'll support you because we want to marginalize the Hindu nationalists, but we are also going to become your main opposition. This is not the united front, and this is not sort of left adventurism. They created a new political space, which I'm interested in having a conversation about.
Very
exciting. It was independent line and yet supporting the centrists to shut out the fascists. So that's the thing with the Indian political scenario today and the position of the left. Now, how the left wins 61 seats, that's a crazy thing. I mean, I'm interested, Eric, and when I read American left periodicals and other things, I read all the newspapers. I'm so amazed sometimes to read how sectarian people are. They take positions against Cuba easily. They want purity. I mean, purity is, you know, for the devil. It's not for us. We are people who are in the middle of class struggles, and class struggles demand, you know, two things. One is you have to have an ideology, which cannot be a dogma. It has to be a guide to action. So, you know, if you're a Marxist, your Marxism should be a guide to action. It should not be a dogma. And secondly, you have to, you know, rumble with where people are. You cannot believe that you can make the world in your own image. And this is a lesson from places like India and elsewhere, where their ideology is a guide to action, and yet they are willing to rumble.
Well, this is great. I mean, Thursday night, as you can see, folks, willing to rumble. It sounds like sometimes when they have these wrestling promotion, you know, are you ready to rumble? Come on out and listen to Vijay Prashad take on Leanne Hurst, man, Thursday night at Oranau, at the Oranau Forum, September 1st at 7 p.m. at Kadesan, 2845 West 7th Street. That's on the corner of Hoover. Call 213-387-2800. And I think, Vijay, that's the idea of Let's Talk Politics. I mean, you know, you continue to do it with Vijay Prashad as a professor of international studies at Trinity College, but an all-around great troublemaker. He's going to be there along with Leanne Hurst, man, Barbara Lott Holland, Kikanza Ramsey, Tammy Liu, Mark Anthony Johnson, Manuel Criollo, and we're going to have a multiracial, multilingual conversation about the future of the left. We're very happy you're coming to L.A., Vijay, and meeting, of course, with people at the Strategy Center. Why don't we end, since you're just such a great roamer, in the sense of, I mean, your grasp of international relations is great. Why don't you have about three more minutes? Let's move to Hugo Chavez, because it seems to me that we've gone from the Middle East to the Indian subcontinent to Hugo Chavez seems to me the most hopeful, historically important breakthrough in our present lifetime, a fascinating transition of his own development from perhaps progressive dictator, progressive military man to actually some experiment with left democracy, and I think evolving his own socialist politics, maybe some analogy with what happened to Fidel, where it took the Bay of Pigs, you know, I mean, he was left when he came in, but it's nothing like the Bay of Pigs to raise your consciousness. What do you think of Chavez, and what do you think his impact has been throughout the world in terms of your tracking of his own development?
You know, before I begin, I want to promote something which is going to come out soon, published by Verso Books.
Okay.
And it is the second volume of his second book on Venezuela by Richard Gott. His first book was on the developments in Venezuela which led to Chavez. And the second book, it's just going to come out in the next few months, is called The Bolivarian Revolution. It's important to remember, by the way, that Richard Gott was the guardian of London's journalist who was the first English language journalist to break the news that Che Guevara was dead.
Hmm.
He was in Bolivia and he saw the body and he identified Che. And there's a very famous photograph of Gott leaning over the body of Che and he said, "It is Che indeed." So anyway, I would like to recommend Richard Gott's two books on Venezuela, the second of which is a full assessment of the Chavez regime. From my understanding, if you go back to the 1950s and 60s, to the formation of OPEC, one of the architects of the formation of OPEC was a Venezuelan, Mr. Perez, Alfonso Perez. He and a Saudi who was known as the Red Sheikh, it's a tremendously interesting story, a left-wing Saudi and Alfonso Perez were the architects of OPEC. Perez was the minister of minerals and mines in Venezuela. He, by the way, never lit his home after the sun set. He used to sit with candles, and he never drove anywhere. If he didn't need to, he walked everywhere. He was head of Venezuelan petroleum, but he decided that oil is the patrimony of the people of the future. It is not to be wasted today, and oil wealth should be put to social development. Two pillars of Alfonso Perez's idea. Now, Chavez is an inheritor of Perez Alfonso in this sense. He is one of the few people in what used to be the third world who has power, has a relative anti-imperialist ideology, but has the ability, the economic ability, to put his agenda in motion. There were many people like Chavez around the world, and there continue to be people like Chavez. But most of them come in countries which are either already broke or have nothing which is valued in the world sufficiently to provide them any leverage. And Chavez is lucky because if the Red Sheikh and Alfonso Perez hadn't created OPEC, the price of oil would not be where it is today. See, they did this agenda in the 60s and 70s in order, not just for oil, but they wanted all commodity cartels to be created. But so Chavez is the beneficiary, and indeed we'll talk more, but Chavez plays a very important role today, precisely because he has his hand on the spigot.
That's a great way to end, hand on the spigot. Vijay Prashad, it's been very, very great to have you on the show. We look forward to seeing you Thursday night, and we look forward to our audience joining him and the other speakers Thursday night. 213-387-2800 for information. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have Leanne Hurst Mann, the editor of Order Now.